More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. At least 21,000 Black Americans have died from COVID-19 since the pandemic began. According to a study from the APM Research Lab, if health outcomes were more equitable in America, 13,000 of those Black Americans would still be alive today. In addition to the high-profile police killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, tens of thousands of Black Americans have had to grieve these preventable COVID deaths in social isolation. Here in Wisconsin, the situation is no less grim. According to that same APM study, we're third in the nation for highest COVID death rates among Black people. Last week, Lake Effect's Julian Haida answered a Bubbler Talk question about why that might be. For that story, he interviewed a geneticist named Joseph Graves, author of The Race Myth: Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. In this bonus Bubbler Talk, you'll hear that full interview. Julian begins by asking Professor Graves if negative health outcomes for Black Americans are inevitable.
Okay, so if we talk about race the way most people think of race as in a biological entity, then the answer is no. If we think about race with regard to the way it has been socially defined and lived in the United States, I would say that these health outcomes with regard to the coronavirus infection were in fact entirely predictable. And I did predict them early on in the epidemic, even before the data came out. So at the level of biological variation of humans, this virus is a new virus. It crossed over into the human population from bats or maybe the pangolin, which is a mammal also. But at the end of the day, there's no humans had any immunity to this virus. And so no group of humans was more or less susceptible to it. But the social conditions that people live in played the biggest role in determining who was infected and who died and who is going to continue to die from COVID-19.
Now, whether it be in China, people are talking about how, you know, high rates of smoking tobacco maybe contributed to the high rates of death. And here in the U.S., when people talk about high rates of kind of Black fatality from COVID-19, they talk about predisposition to heart disease, diabetes. This is in medical journals as well. Now, when it comes to medical predisposition to the coronavirus through things like heart disease, through things like diabetes, how are those things socially reified versus something that might be genetic?
Well, if you look at the prevalence of heart disease and diabetes in the United States, there are socially defined populations that have a greater prevalence of these diseases. And again, people often assume that that greater prevalence is being driven by some underlying genetic difference. And in fact, there's really little to no evidence of that. And really all the evidence speaks the other way, that it's really environmental differences that are contributing to the differences in the rates of heart disease and diabetes between African Americans and European Americans. The genetic argument really just doesn't hold up when we look at genetic variants that are associated with risk of these disease. For example, with regard to hypertension, people of European descent actually have a higher frequency of the genes that predispose people to hypertension than African Americans do. So if we were going to make a genetic argument, you would expect European Americans have higher rates of hypertension and then higher rates of diabetes and to be dying at higher rates of COVID-19. But that's in fact the exact opposite of what we see. So the genetic argument really doesn't stand up, but there are all sorts of environmental differences that predispose people to disease. Poor diets, environmental toxins, and things of that sort, which are differentially visited on persons of African descent in the United States and have historically been differentially visited on persons of African descent in the United States. So again, for those of us who study this problem, the COVID outbreak and its severity amongst the African-American population was not a surprise, not at all.
Give us some examples of some of those environmental factors. Here in Wisconsin, the fatality rate among Black Wisconsinites is several times higher than it is in a place like LA or New York or even in Georgia. Why might that be? What would be the environmental differences between these places?
I would think that the evidence that we have right now, probably the strongest indicator of one's likelihood to come down with the disease, is your likelihood to be in contact with someone who's carrying the disease. And that's strongly related to the population density in the area in which you live. So, you know, what's called social distancing is really physical distancing. And if you live in a single dwelling that's an acre apart from the next single dwelling, and you're relatively sufficient with regard to supplies like water and groceries, and you can call out and have those things delivered readily, then you're very likely not to come into contact with anybody who's carrying the virus. But if you live in crowded conditions, and in addition, you have multiple individuals living within your dwelling, and you either have to go to work because you're in one of these industries that's called an essential industry, like, for example, working at a grocery store or working in transportation or in working in health, as a healthcare provider, then you're more likely to come in contact with the virus. And that's really the only major thing that we're seeing with regard to transmission. That is, the density of individuals increasing the probability that you come in contact with someone who's carrying the virus.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into something you said earlier about population density and the spread of the coronavirus. I mean, again, a place like New York City is more dense than Milwaukee, but Milwaukee is also the most segregated city in the country. The urban-suburban divide is one that often is a racial divide. Do you think the disproportionality plays into that a little bit more given the way those lines are socially drawn, or did New York just do a better job containing the virus?
I'm not sure that New York did a better job. New York was the first major hotspot in the United States. But I do think that patterns of racial segregation played a role in the spread of this virus. And again, the key thing is not coming in contact with somebody who has it. So if you have a community where you have disproportionate numbers of people who are likely to come in contact with the virus, and that community is itself segregated from other elements of the community, then you're going to see a much higher prevalence of the infection in that community. And if that's what happened in Wisconsin, that would explain the differential rates there. In New York, initially, we didn't have data on racial disparity, but as soon as the data came out, we saw the same thing in New York and New Jersey and other states that have large ethnic minority populations are showing the same pattern. So racial segregation does play a role in and it always has.
Now, are you afraid that given all the headlines, given all the attention that's given to the racial disparities here, that this will prove yet again to people the assumption that racial difference is genetic inherently?
Well, quite frankly, it depends upon who's spinning the narrative. And unfortunately, there are enough people presenting the old genetic race syllogism that this isn't going to change the conversation. And again, this is one of the most unfortunate things that's going to come out of this pandemic, is that it's going to be back to business as usual once people feel like they're, quote, safe. And examples of this, of course, are demonstrations in states like Michigan, where AR-15 toting persons of European descent are descending upon the state house, demanding that the economy and businesses be opened up again. And if you'll note, if you look in those crowds, you know, you don't see too many people of African descent being involved in this. So quite frankly, I don't see any evidence that this narrative is going to change with regard to the social causation of disease and the social privileges that people who have, for the most part, or I won't say for the most part, but what differentially escaped the ravages of this disease are going to, in terms of their ongoing behavior. So you're right. I don't see this narrative changing at all.
So say someone is empowered to change this, though, and improve the disparities in these health outcomes. This is the wave of the magic wand question. What kind of changes would have to happen to flatten the racial disparities in something like the coronavirus?
Well, you know, I've said this over and over again, so this will be yet another program in which I say this. I don't think that any health disparities will ever be solved under capitalism. It's an economic system that creates disparity, that creates injustice, that creates differentials in wealth and health. It's simply the way the system works. It can't work any other way. And that's the great conundrum that this society refuses to face, is that the outcomes that we see in the U.S. society are directly related to how the society was structured and how it operates. So there are no reforms that are going to change health outcomes in the United States under the present socioeconomic system. It just simply can't happen. That's like asking an elephant to suddenly take off and fly. Elephants can't fly. And so if you want to change health outcomes, whether it be from infectious disease or chronic diseases of living in a socioeconomic system, you need to change the nature of that system. So, I mean, immediate things can be done. For example, having a single payer insurance. So what Bernie Sanders was campaigning on, Medicare for all. Okay, no one in the United States should be without appropriate health care. And what I mean by that is that the health care that the richest people in this nation get, the poorest people in this nation should have as well. And even if, you know, you don't believe in that kind of social equity with regard to care, you should be self-motivated to want that to happen. Because whenever you have people who don't have access to health care, that means that they're going to be far more likely to become infected with a transmissible disease and to spread that transmissible disease. And since even wealthy people rely on poorer people to be able to live in their daily lives, and what I mean by that is the people who work in the meat packaging plants, the people who work in agriculture, the people who work keeping the lights on, the people who work, you know, educating your kids, you're not going to be able to stay away from infectious disease because the disease doesn't know any color line and it doesn't know any class line with regard to its capacity to infect individuals. So even if you thought this is a terrible thing, it actually is the best thing with regard to being able to control infectious disease. And what I mean by that is if everyone has access to appropriate healthcare, then we're able to both monitor the onset of infectious disease and stop its spread. Okay, so we need to start with those kinds of changes. But at the end of the day, unless we change the fundamental ways in which we live, we are going to have pandemic after pandemic after pandemic, and it's always going to be poor people and racially subordinated people who die the most.
I wanted to ask one more question, and this is a little bit more theoretical. Say the economic system completely gets overhauled, and yet, you know, we like our kind of our cultures, especially marginalized cultures. How do those cultures persist without necessarily falling to the kind of nationalist discourses of we are the best racially and ethnically, no matter how groups might be stratified economically and otherwise?
Well, I've never been a champion of the superiority of one culture over another. My view is that cultures have evolved. They have differences. But even within, you know, if you look at the overall characteristics of human cultures, we share far more in common than we are different. And so, you know, people try to, and in some sense as a response to being subordinated, try to uplift different aspects of their culture, and they use it as a rallying cry in a way to make the oppression not as bad as it is. I've never done that. There are things that I appreciate in all human cultures. And there are amazing parallels. Like if you listen to Mississippi Delta blues and you see it as a cultural art form, there are similar art forms that evolved independently all over the world. I mean, Okinawan blues is amazingly similar to Mississippi Delta blues. And the two cultures had no direct contact. So again, it underscores the unity of the human experience. And that's always been what I have championed as a scholar and as an activist, is what holds us together. And I think that's where we need to be with regard to moving forward to making a just and equitable world. We have to emphasize the things that we share, the things that all human beings need, the things that all human beings appreciate. And that's the thing I want to emphasize in my discourse about moving our nation and the world forward towards something that I would call just and equitable.
Yeah, it's just way too easy to rest on those laurels of biological difference. So that's why we call you.
Because biology as destiny is a simple explanation, and it's used to cover up the more fundamental dynamics of injustice.
Joseph Graves is Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Biological Studies at the Joint School for Nanoscience and Nanoengineering. He's also the author of The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida for last week's edition of Bubbler Talk, which you can hear at WUWM.com or by downloading the Bubbler Talk podcast wherever you get your podcasts.